A lot of times we eat a food or a dish without knowing too much about its background or the people who made it. We eat at a new restaurant, try a new recipe, try a different regional food, whatever it might be. This week's Food Friday guest wanted to write a cookbook that shared the stories of the people behind the food. She presents the recipes along with the life and culture of the people who introduced it to her. Yasmin Khan is an author, campaigner, and cook. She's passionate about sharing people's stories through food. Her latest cookbook is called Zaytoun, Recipes from the Palestinian Kitchen. Yasmin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, I think a lot of times when we hear about the Palestinian people here in the United States, it's as part of a crisis, a problem, a conflict. You are bringing their lives to us through food. Can you tell us why you wanted to make that a priority?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, too often, we kind of tend to see certain people from certain bits of the world through a very narrow political prism. And, Palestine's a classic example. And I wanted to really use food as a way of sharing stories that humanize Palestinians, that share some of the beauty and joy that exist in their culture and celebrate their incredible food.
And just about every culture in the world has a food tradition that they love, that they're proud of. Can you talk about how the Palestinian people you talk to express themselves through food?
Sure. Well, for my book, so I'm a travel writer, and my cookbooks are primarily about me kind of going on a journey through a place, cooking with people in their home kitchens, or perhaps kind of, you know, discovering kind of restaurants and specialized kind of eateries that really represent a community. And so for the book, I traveled through Palestinian kitchens in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, and it was a real delight actually to be able to anyone who's traveled to that bit of the world will tell you, I mean, it used to be called the Fertile Crescent for a reason. It's a place where produce is just so fresh and flavorsome. I mean, you know, a simple tomato is so aromatic, you could just bite into it like an apple. But Palestinian food has got a lot of things that, you know, we'll be familiar with, you know, perhaps like bright kind of fattoush salads or tabbouleh, you know, herb-filled salads. And it also has a lot of stuffed vegetables, whether it's eggplants or, you know, peppers, you know, incredible braised okra dishes. And, you know, what I found as someone who, you know, in a region that I think we can all safely say, you know, we more commonly associate with conflict, with, you know, human rights issues, it food is just such a wonderful vehicle for discovery.
Well, let's get into some of the flavors that you encountered in Palestinian cooking. Let's start with the one that you chose for the title of your book, and I hope I'm saying it right, Zaytoun, the olives of the region.
Yes. So Zaytoun means olive in Arabic, but also Turkish and Farsi. It's a very common word in that region. And, you know, if there's one ingredient that is emblematic of Palestinian cookery, it's the olive. Small, you know, bowls of olives are present in almost every meal, whether it's breakfast, lunch, or dinner. And most Palestinians have olive trees that they tend to, and the olive festival, the olive harvest festival that takes place in the autumn is a major cultural celebration. And for many Palestinians, the olive tree also represents their connection to the land. And when the olive tree is uprooted, also their displacement. So, you know, for all of those reasons, you know, olives seem to be like a great place to start.
Yasmin Khan is with us talking about her new book, Zaytoun, Recipes from the Palestinian Kitchen. Yasmin, let's talk about the spice palette that's present in a lot of Palestinian cooking. What kind of things are we sprinkling in here?
So it's Palestinian cookery is very delicately flavored, using spices such as allspice and cinnamon and cumin in savory cooking. And this was a big discovery for me because, you know, I growing up in the UK, allspice would be something that we kind of basically use for, you know, cakes and cookies and pies. And in Palestinian cookery, it was just so wonderful to find it as a marinade for meat dishes or added to stews, or perhaps, you know, a pinch sprinkled onto a salad as part of a dressing. And it's that kind of subtle warming spice that really makes me think of Palestinian cuisine.
Yeah, I have a kind of a knockoff chicken shawarma recipe that includes allspice, and that is something that makes it really distinctive, right?
It's very unique. Honestly, I think for me, you know, and I think of myself, you know, I've written about Middle Eastern food a lot and have, you know, I consider myself, you know, a bit of an expert. For me, that was just such a great surprise to find this new ingredient that I already had in my kitchen cupboard that I could just use in a different way.
And I'm happy to say a lot of the spices that are present there in the Mideast, we can find here in the Midwest. Like most of the stuff is available in stores. I want to talk about one that I have seen, but not as often. Za'atar, am I saying that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the two ingredients that perhaps you might be a bit unfamiliar with are sumac, which is this kind of astringent ground kind of powder from the sumac berry, and that's used to add like a lovely sharpness to dishes. And then also za'atar, which is this really fragrant aromatic spice mix made with they translate it as a type of wild thyme, but it's got more of an affinity with oregano and marjoram. But anyway, so it's that herb mixed with sesame seeds and sumac, and it's a really common Palestinian condiment, really. And Palestinian quite commonly would kind of tear off a bit of bread, dunk it in a bit of olive oil, and then tap it into the za'atar, and it makes just for a lovely little, you know, snack before you have your main meal.
And you were cooking with people in their own kitchens. We're talking about Palestinian cooking, but are there variations that might be from one person to, you know, the neighborhood across town or even the next door neighbor?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what struck me the most about traveling through the region, which is very small, was that it reminded me a lot of when you're in Italy and, you know, you'd go from 10 miles down the road and people would insist that the tomato sauce is done a particular way. And it felt very, very similar. I mean, I was really lucky for the process of the book. And, you know, these stories are chronicled in it. But I did all kinds of things from, you know, making a fattoush salad with an opera singer in Jerusalem to visiting the Middle East's first microbrewery, Tiber, just outside of Bethlehem, that are making incredible kind of beers and stouts and ales made from local Palestinian ingredients, to kind of joining the olive harvest in the north of kind of Jenin, to kind of visiting baklava pastry shops. And what I kind of learned on that journey is that, you know, Palestinian cookery can be split into three main areas. So you've got the food from the Galilee, which is more vegetable based. You know, I described some of those flavors earlier, things like the, you know, the braised okra or the stuffed eggplant, lots of seafood coming from the coasts. Then you've got the food from the West Bank, which is more influenced by Bedouin culture, and that's more, you know, more meat based. So one of my favorite recipes in the book is for this juicy pieces of roast chicken that have been marinated in allspice and sumac and then roasted in the oven with red onions and layered onto flatbreads with the meat put on top, and then all the juice from the chicken kind of poured on top of the bread, so it just kind of like oozes into it and you tear it apart with your hands. Like, that's just a real classic kind of meat-based dish from the West Bank. And then, you know, from a culinary point of view as well, the food from the Gaza Strip was the most extraordinary. You know, in Gaza, which again we most commonly associate with the blockade, you know, the food there has, it's, you know, the holy trinity of flavors is green chili and garlic and dill. So like dill seed is used in a lot of Gazan cookery, as well as like, you know, the fronds. And Gazan cuisine, you know, traditionally, again, kind of uses a lot of seafood, a lot of shrimp, and it's very punchy and intense. But of course, it's also the cuisine that's the most under threat. And, you know, because of the blockade, we now have a situation where, you know, sadly about 80% of Gazans are dependent on UN food aid to survive.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Yasmin Khan, author of the book Zaytoun, Recipes from the Palestinian Kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered Palestinian food? Did you grow up with Palestinian food? Is it part of your tradition? Have you traveled in the area yourself? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have recipes, by the way, at wpr.org/foodfriday, a salad and a spinach and feta packets. We'll get into those in just a bit, too. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation on Food Friday. Yasmin Khan is with us talking about her latest cookbook, Zaytoun, Recipes from the Palestinian Kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest about Palestinian food. Maybe tell us about your own experiences with Palestinian food, eating it or cooking it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Yasmin, I mentioned you shared a couple recipes with us. We've got those up at WPR.org/Food Friday. I love this one for a cold Wisconsin day. The everyday Palestinian salad seems like it could really bring a taste of summer with it. Talk about this one, please.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that you'll find in the Palestinian kitchen or when you're sitting down to share Palestinian meals is that there'll always be a fresh salad on the table, something with a bit of crunch and texture to, yeah, I guess, complement some of the richer stews. So this is a really easy chopped salad with diced cucumber and red onion and tomato and with a few kind of herbs kind of run through it. And it's just, you know, dressed really simply with olive oil and lemon juice. And it sounds so simple, but actually there's something about the kind of flavor combinations that just make it like an incredible, incredible simple salad.
And in your recipe, you've got the herbs as parsley and mint. Could we play around with substituting other fresh herbs?
I think with this one, no, you really want to go for the parsley and mint because they're the ones that, you know, the mint and the parsley, I don't know, they're just like a marriage made in heaven with those vegetables. So you want to stick to those. Cilantro is going to take off in a different direction.
What are some of the other common salads you might encounter at pretty much any meal?
Yeah, well, you always have fresh vegetables in the forms of little pickles. So they could be kind of beets or turnips. So they're just super easy to make. And I have chronicled quite a few recipes for them in the book. One thing that I really enjoyed, which is a seasonal salad that's good for this time of year, and is a salad that I enjoyed when I was in Ramallah in the West Bank. And it is for this salad made with arugula and radicchio and clementines, and then some radishes. So you have all these kind of vibrant winter vegetables, and then you dress it with, again, just like a sweet vinegar. You can use kind of a bit of date molasses or maple syrup if you have it, and then lots of good quality olive oil.
Let's talk a little bit about olive oil. Actually, we talked about the olives themselves. Olive oil, a big thing, obviously. Is olive oil from the region, from the Palestinian region, going to be different than what we might get from France or Spain or California?
Yeah, so it's a little bit more peppery. It's closer to Greek olive oil, but not quite as pungent and intense. So it works, you know. I do love Greek olive oil, but sometimes it is a bit strong for me. And Palestinian olive oil is a lot lighter, a bit more grassy with a tint of citrus. And it's really common in Palestinian kitchens when you kind of go into people's homes to see kind of several bottles of olive oil on the go because, you know, you never want to be cooking with the best quality olive oil. You just want to be using that to finish dishes. But lighter olive oils or little blends of olive oils are much better for frying baking or something.
And in the book, you mention a lot of the different food traditions that have crossed paths in the Middle East and been part of what is now Palestinian cooking. Can you talk about some of the different foods that have come across this crossroads from other parts of the world?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at a bit of the world that, you know, over several millennia has had so many different empires go through it, you know, like from the Romans to, you know, the Greeks, to the Arabs, to the Persians, to the Ottoman Empire. I think kind of the Ottoman Empire, the kind of from Turkey, probably has had the most influence on the food that you see today. But what I think was really incredible was when you go through Palestinian villages, you know, there are certain dishes that you know, are very local to the Palestinian kitchen. So Nablus, for example, is this town in the West Bank, which is where kanafe originated. And kanafe is this really unusual Middle Eastern now because it's spread throughout the region, but Palestinian dessert, which, you know, I always describe as like the love child of a baklava and a cheesecake, because it's kind of like, and it's exactly as kind of, you know, as delicious as that sounds. But it's basically warm cheese. It's kind of, they call it a kawi cheese, but I make it in my book with just like a mozzarella, that's like an unsalted mozzarella that you top with flaky pastry, and then you heat in the oven, and then when it's hot and the cheese is all melted, you douse it in this gorgeous like rose water or orange blossom and cardamom sweet syrup. So it's kind of sweet and sticky and crunchy and gooey. It's a real treat.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about Palestinian cuisine. Yasmin Khan is with us. Her new book is called Zaytoun, Recipes from the Palestinian Kitchen. I want to check out another recipe now, Yasmin, that we've got at WPR.org/Food Friday, the spinach and feta parcels. How did you learn how to make these?
So this was in the house of, for the book, I collaborated with a local Palestinian photographer called Raya Manna. She was this incredible, like, punk Palestinian photographer. And this is a recipe I learned from her mum. Her mum was a school teacher. Living in this village called Majd al-Karum, in the north of the Galilee. And what these parcels are, they're called fataya in Arabic, and they're really lovely kind of yogurt dough enriched pastries that are stuffed with spinach, although you can use chard as well, feta cheese, and then they're kind of sharpened with sumac, that astringent spice I talked about, and they're really fun to make kind of with kids. We kind of had little kids running around while we were doing them, because kids always love little tactile things to make, and they're really kind of homely and warming, and, you know, when we're looking forward towards the summer months, which we're not quite there yet, they're also really great kind of picnic food.
And we've got this dough with as you said, the yogurt in it. The yogurt, I guess, is what puts it over the top here.
Yeah, it adds, it's made with yogurt and a little bit of olive oil. It adds just a lovely tang to the dough and makes it slightly fluffy, which I really like.
And do we end up frying this or baking it? How does it get cooked?
No, you just pop it in the oven and bake it.
Okay. Well, it looks really good. I'm looking at the picture right now and it looks awesome. Now, one thing, we don't have recipes up for this, but I don't want to get through this without talking about some of the stews you ran into. Can you tell us about the tradition? There's a lot of variety of the stew in Palestinian cooking.
There is. And I think the one that I'm going to talk about is the one, you know, it's always the more unusual ones that strike you. So, and this is the thing about Palestinian cookery. It's generally using ingredients that we're familiar with, but just using them in a different way. So this is a Gazan stew called sumagaya, and it's made with beef and chard and chickpeas, which you're thinking, okay, so that's not so unusual. But then what makes it special is the addition of tahini and sumac. So you get this kind of like nutty, creamy, kind of slightly sharp sauce, but actually it works so well with like, you know, slow cooked beef and chickpeas. So I always recommend people give that a go, because it's like slightly unusual, but, you know, really packs a punch in terms of flavor.
And you open the book, and some of these pictures caught us right away with some hummus recipes. What kind of variation do you see in the hummus, this mushed up chickpea, lemon, olive oil, garlic stuff?
I know. I feel like hummus and falafel are two things that can just be the most underwhelming food things as food items. You know, we've all like, I never really got falafel until I went to Bethlehem for the first time. You know, falafel is just so dry and mealy here. And then like you go to, you know, go to the region and it's filled with kind of, you know, it's crunchy and flavorsome. Hummus was really lovely. To learn kind of how Palestinians make it. So the hummus, Palestinian hummus has got a lot more tahini than kind of the stuff that we tend to buy in shops. And there are a few little knacks that I include in the book on how to make really good hummus, like, you know, by adding a few ice cubes, which There's a very magic trick to somehow kind of change the consistency of it as you're making it. But what's really great is on my first day when I landed, Raya, my photographer, I told you about, she said, well, let's go and have a traditional Palestinian breakfast. So we went off to a hummus joint because that is a really traditional breakfast. And you can get hummus with a variety of toppings. So you can get it with, it's like chickpea on chickpea. So like the hummus, and on top of it, you'd have this really gorgeous, warm chickpea, green chili, garlic and olive oil kind of base stew that's put on top of it. Or the one that I, went crazy for was kind of seared pieces of lamb, just kind of flash cooked, that are then put on top of the hummus. And that is just such an incredible combination. So yeah, I've included recipes for those in the book as well.
I was going to say, I was looking at that hummus with spiced lamb and trying to talk the producers into running home, making it and bringing it in for me. No luck, not yet. I wanted to ask, Yasmin, having been through this experience, spending so much time in Palestinian kitchens, learning how to make these, are there a couple of recipes that are now kind of part of your daily repertoire, either for the food themselves or the memories now they have for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I think the allspice thing was just a real game changer for me. And just like last week, I was making like a chickpea, a garbanzo stew, and I was like, oh, I must add like some allspice to it. So I think that is something that's definitely stayed with me. And then I think, I don't know, it's so many things. You know, I think the other thing is perhaps how, you know, there are a couple of recipes in the book, and certainly it's a big tradition in Palestine of having kind of vegetables that are, it's called cooked in oil, but it's basically like kind of a lightly kind of sauteed vegetable with fresh tomatoes. And now I do that quite a lot, you know, whether it's with green beans, whether it's with okra. Just there's something about Palestinian cookery that's very simple. You know, a lot of it just rests on having really good quality ingredients and really good quality olive oil. And I think it's the research of the book really kind of made me re-remember why those elements are so important in cooking.
Yasmin, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Yasmin Khan. Her new book is called Zaytoun Recipes from the Palestinian Kitchen. You can find two of those recipes, the Everyday Palestinian Salad and the Spinach and Feta Parcels, at wpr.org/foodfriday. A U.S. Coast Guard lieutenant is being accused of planning an act of domestic terrorism after an investigation found a large stockpile of weapons and ammunition at his home. Law enforcement also discovered what appeared to amount to a hit list targeting high-profile journalists and Democratic lawmakers, including Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, among others. Federal prosecutors allege the man self-identified as a white nationalist and spent hours researching ways to carry out large-scale attacks and reading manifestos of other terrorists, even on his work computer. Our next guest is here with the latest. Dan Lamothe is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We'll give a little bit of the basics there. Dan, can you flesh out the case a little more for us? What do we know?
So this investigation began last fall. The Coast Guard has some systems in place where they monitor for potential insider threats. And it appears that some computer internet searches that this individual, Christopher Hassan, was running on his work computer sent up some red flags. And from there, they launched an investigation, started looking into kind of what he'd been doing. At this point, we have charges that range from some purchasing of weapons that were outside the bounds, apparently, and also some drug charges, specifically the alleged purchase of steroids. The government is still looking at potential additional charges that would be more on the terrorism side of things.
And do we have an idea of a timeline and when further charges might be coming?
Right now, we have a 14-day window that was set up in federal court in Maryland yesterday. He will be held for the next 14 days. Assumably, by the end of that time frame, we would be looking at potential charges.
And the white nationalist angle there, what kind of things did prosecutors reveal that they had found out?
So specifically, he came right out in a number of letters and emails proclaiming himself as a white nationalist. He particularly was interested in the writings of Anders Breivik, who was a terrorist who killed 77 people in Norway a few years ago, and was... some of his writings, he basically suggested that he had been keeping a low profile, and he had also been developing a target list. How serious he was about that, I think, is still unclear at this point.
Can you tell us a little more about the names, the kinds of people on that target list?
Yes, I mean, they're names that a good deal of your listeners would be familiar with, ranging from people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, some CNN personalities, some other member of the Congress. They were all Democrats, for the most part, on the lawmaker side, and then members of the media.
Talking to Dan Lamoth from the Washington Post. He's a national security reporter there, talking about Christopher Hassan, the Coast Guard lieutenant, arrested, accused of apparently plotting white nationalist attacks. But Dan, as you said, it's not clear if there was a specific plan in place to make attacks, right?
Right. Where we are in this situation is, in so many cases, we often hear about attacks after they've occurred, and there are all these red flags, and, you know, why wasn't this caught earlier, and that kind of thing. In this case, they appear to have caught things that were troubling, but, you know, how far down the road we were and whether or not something actually would have happened is obviously an uncertain.
And you mentioned the case of Anders Breivik from Norway, who had made the attacks there. It appears that Christopher Hassan had read his manifesto and was apparently using some of the methodology, including taking drugs that the Norwegian terrorist had recommended. Can you talk about that part of the story?
Yes, specifically, he was interested in steroids. Prosecutors had said that he had purchased them on a number of occasions. On at least one occasion, they were sent to a hotel room in Mississippi, which is interesting in this case because as a Coast Guard officer involved with the development of the Coast Guard's national security cutter, he was likely traveling to Mississippi in order to visit shipyards.
Now, one point of concern some people have been raising beyond this story itself is concern about the military's screening of white nationalists, potential terrorists. He's currently a Coast Guard officer. He had also been a Marine previously, worked in Army National Guards in a couple of states, if I recall correctly. Can you talk about that point of concern?
It's a very difficult nut to crack for the military. They screen for troubling ties, be it regular street gang ties or white nationalist ties, in a number of ways. The most specific one is what tattoos do you have as you are presenting yourself as a potential recruit. But if you're not professing anything coming in the door and you don't appear to be someone who has these sort of ideologies, it's very hard to suss out. If you don't have a criminal record, I mean, there are only, you know, it's difficult to find these people before they do anything troubling.
Was there any indication that he was affiliated with any kind of white nationalist organizations?
Nothing specific other than the ideology seemed to have caught his interest. I don't recall seeing that he had joined any specific groups or anything like that in the filing. It was more that this seemed to be attractive to him.
What have we heard from Hassan's attorneys in court so far?
Largely, they are billing this as sort of an overblown, exaggerated set of allegations, particularly on the side of what his motives might have been or what he might have been planning to do next.
And you mentioned that the investigation goes back some months, I think you said, till last fall. Did prosecutors give any indication of why they acted this week?
No, nothing specifically other than they felt that they finally had enough there to go forward. It is yet to be determined whether or not there was any trigger that would have prompted them to go now as opposed to continue to wait and gather information. Both the FBI and the Coast Guard Investigative Service were involved.
And in addition to firearms and a potential firearm attack, I believe some of his communications or notes indicated that he was interested in some kind of biological weapons attack. Were there mentions of that?
There were. I mean, and it was mostly, it was sort of all these different ways that he might, that he was dreaming or interested in harming people or causing violence in order to further a specific end. And one of the quotes in there was, "I am dreaming of a way to kill almost every last person on Earth."
Have we seen much in the way of reaction in national politics from the White House or Congress to this case?
The president actually weighed in this afternoon, and he sort of drew a distinction. I mean, he was surprised and seemingly troubled by what he saw in this case. He was then asked if his own previous remarks aimed at some of these same individuals had in any way caused this or been tied to it, and he said that he thought he had basically spoken very nicely.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Dan, what details are you watching for next in this story?
I think there are two threads of the poll. One are the specifics of how far down the road or not was any kind of attack, whether or not that is more circumstantial and more something that they were concerned about, but there wasn't anything concrete. The second piece of this is that there's the many-layered onion of how white nationalism finds its way into the military, how much of a problem or not that it is. It tends to present itself in sort of these individual cases. You may recall another one where there was a Marine involved in all the ugliness in Charlottesville a couple years.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dan Lamothe is a national security reporter at The Washington Post. He joined us today to give us the latest on an alleged domestic terrorism plot planned by a lieutenant in the U.S. Coast Guard. A Night at the Garden is a short documentary film that's up for an Academy Award this Sunday. It's a haunting look at a forgotten bit of American history in the days before World War II. WPR's Judith Sears-Poisson recently talked with filmmaker Marshall Curry and historian Mark D. Van Els about the American Nazi group that gathered in New York City in 1939 and the group's connections to Wisconsin.
Marshall Curry is the filmmaker behind the short documentary A Night at the Garden. Marshall, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your film, A Night at the Garden, is a 7-minute compilation of archival footage from a gathering of the German-American Bund at Madison Square Garden in New York City in 1939. How did you first become aware of this gathering?
I was at dinner with a friend of mine who was writing a screenplay that takes place in New York in 1939. And he told me that there had been a rally that year in which 20,000 Americans filled Madison Square Garden to celebrate Nazism. And I didn't believe him at the time, actually, until I got home that night and looked it up. And I got an archival researcher who was a friend to start digging around, and he found some footage in the National Archive and some in UCLA's archive and Grinberg Archive. And so we gathered it, and when I saw it, I just couldn't believe it.
And were those 20,000 people in Madison Square Garden all members of the German-American Bund, or who were they?
Well, they were supporters at some level of the Bund or of the Bund's philosophy. So it's kind of incredible to think that there could be 20,000 Americans, New Yorkers in a pretty progressive city, that would come out to support fascism and anti-Semitism. And unfortunately, when there's 20,000 that come out for a rally, you know that there are a lot more than that that are supportive but just couldn't get a babysitter that night.
Mm. For those who haven't seen it yet, describe what this looked like.
Well, it's very surreal. The film starts with a shot of the garden, and you think, oh, well, maybe this is going to be about a basketball game or a hockey game. And then we go into the marquee of Madison Square Garden, and it describes it as a pro-America rally. And so maybe you think, well, this is going to be some patriotic gathering. And when you get inside, you see that there are American flags everywhere. Behind the stage, there's a 30-foot portrait of George Washington, but when you look closer, you realize that there are swastikas on either side, and that the people, the thousands of people who are marching into the hall, are carrying American flags, but also flags with swastikas. And then a speaker takes the stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow American patriots,
and starts attacking the press and demonizing minorities, and eventually a protester runs out on stage and is beaten up.
Tell us us about that protester. Who was that?
His name was Isidore Greenbaum. He was just a Jewish plumber's assistant from Brooklyn, just as a 20-something-year-old, went down to the rally to see what this was all about and was so shocked by what he saw that he ran out on stage to try to say something and was beaten up and thrown off stage and eventually arrested. And the next day, according to the New York Times, at his hearing, the magistrate who was sentencing him said to him, "Don't you realize that someone could have been hurt?" And Isidore Greenbaum replied that, "Don't you realize that someone's going to be hurt by the things that were being said up there?" And of course, this is 1939. We know what happened in the next few years.
Your film is presented with no added narration, so you're really letting what we see and hear tell the story without additional context or analysis. How did you decide that that would be the most effective approach?
Well, when I first saw the footage, my first instinct was to make a traditional historical documentary where you have historians provide context and you understand what's going on. And almost on a whim, I decided to try editing it without any explanation. So almost like a Verite documentary or like most movies where nobody interrupts to tell you what you're seeing. And I discovered that it had a real power. It pulled the audience in as you're watching this stuff and you're thinking, what is this? How did this happen? How did I never know about this? And those questions draw the audience in and engage them more deeply than maybe it would have if everything had been delivered like a tidy history lesson.
I pledge undivided allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And now we turn to Mark D. Van Els. He's a professor of history at Queensborough Community College of the City University of New York. He's a Wisconsin native and received his PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So, Mark, have you watched this film, A Night at the Garden?
Yes, I have watched the film. It was very interesting, and I suppose, like a lot of Americans, what I was immediately brought back to was the Charlottesville episode. And it seemed to me you could draw some parallels between what we've seen recently and what was in that film. Some of those issues are still very timely, unfortunately.
Well, tell us more about the German-American Bund on the national level to start with.
Yeah, all right. Well, it really has its origins with the Nazi movement in Germany, which began to emerge in the 1920s. Germany had been defeated in the First World War. Its economy was ravaged, and it was undergoing a great deal of political turmoil. There was a strong communist movement that was beginning to develop in Germany, and the rise of the communist movement in turn led to the rise of the fascist movement, the Nazi Party. Many of the people who would later become activists in the German-American Bund in the United States had been in the German army during the First World War, had participated in some of the political street fighting that occurred in Germany immediately after the war, and they emigrated to America to, like most immigrants do, I suppose, have a better life. But when they came, they oftentimes brought their Nazi ideology with them. They started to form small pro-Nazi groups, actually in coordination with officials back in Germany. And then when Hitler took power in 1933, these smaller groups came together to form something called the Friends of the New Germany, which created a rift between the U.S. and German governments because there was a Nazi-affiliated movement right here in the United States. So the Friends of the New Germany was sort of rebranded, as we would say today, and it becomes the German-American Bund, or America-Deutscher Volksbund, as it would be in German. This new organization was not affiliated with the Nazi Party, at least officially. Membership was limited to American citizens, and so there were no foreign nationals in the organization. But of course, the organization still kept its pro-Nazi sympathies.
And of course, here in Wisconsin, especially southeastern Wisconsin, there was a very large German population. Who among our fellow Wisconsinites were drawn to the Bund's message?
Well, I'm glad to say not that many. It was mostly those people who had immigrated to America after the First World War. Something like 90% of known Bund members were recent immigrants to the United States. The Bund hoped to infiltrate the more traditional German-American communities, the sports clubs, the singing organizations, and that led to a big rift within the German-American community itself. At first, the larger German-American community tried to ignore the problem, but when the Bund got more assertive, when it became more publicly visible, that led to an open break among German-Americans.
The Bund also ran a youth camp in Wisconsin, in Grafton, called Camp Hindenburg. What went on there?
The Bund, as it was organized, bore some striking similarities to the Nazi Party in Germany itself. There was, for example, something called the Ordnungsdienst, or Order Division, much like the stormtroopers you found in Nazi Germany with the jackboots and the brown shirts and all these sorts of things. And in Germany, infamously, there was something called the Hitler Youth, the Hitler Jugend, and there was that equivalent in the German-American Bund as well. It was called the Jugendschaft. The Bund liked to portray it as the equivalent of the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. You know, we're getting the kids out of the city and into God's free air and all these types of things, but they're also learning about Nazi ideology. So it was remarkably like the Hitler Youth back in Germany.
What effect did America's entrance into World War II have on the Bund?
Well, if you go back even to 1939, one of the main reasons why the Bund grew as much as it did was fear of communism. And just before World War II started in Europe, Hitler signed a deal with the Soviet Union. And so that sort of took the wind out of their anti-communist sails, I suppose you could say. That was one of the main reasons why the Bund was growing. With Hitler's deal with Stalin, then that was sort of taken off the table. Another factor, I think, is that Germany was a rising power and posed a threat to the United States. So this is also the time, let's talk about 1938, 1939, this is when Austria is absorbed into the German Reich, the Munich Conference appeasement. And as Germany starts to look more and more threatening to the United States, a lot of other Americans began to look askance at the German-American Bund. And then, of course, once America enters the war, many of these people they lose their citizenship, some sent off to internment camps and things like that. But by 1941, the Bund was already really on the ropes. It was after the Second World War begins in Europe that the Bund really begins to show a very sharp decline.
Earlier, you mentioned the white nationalists who were demonstrating in Charlottesville, Virginia, and with tragic consequences. Do you see parallels that should be drawn or could be drawn between the political climate at the time of the Bund and rhetoric today?
Yeah. So these extreme right-wing groups, they always sort of remind me of the main character in one of these slasher movies. Just when you think you've gotten rid of them, the killer always pops up from under the bed or out of the closet or something like this. It does seem to crop up from time to time based on various social conditions in the country. In the 1930s, it was the Great Depression. The rise of communism in this country was another reason why a lot of people, some people turned to the German-American Bund. Today's discussions about immigration have brought up many of those feelings and have brought many of these right-wing groups back out into the open more.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
A Night at the Garden is a short documentary film that's up for an Academy Award this Sunday. WPR's Judith Sears Poisson recently talked with filmmaker Marshall Curry and historian Mark D. Van Els about the American Nazi group that gathered in Madison Square Garden on the eve of World War II and the group's activities in Wisconsin. Oscars coming up Sunday. We'll find out how that documentary does on Sunday night. If you're like a lot of people, including me, you may have had a problem with pimples in your youth, and maybe again in your post-youth, too. Well, it turns out we're not alone. Not only do lots of people get pimples, so do some great works of art. As reported at Smithsonian.com, Wisconsin's own Georgia O'Keeffe noticed during her career a problem with some of her paintings. Over time, little dots would appear on them, tiny bumps. O'Keefe thought it maybe was from sand she had left Wisconsin to paint in a desert landscape. But on closer inspection, art conservationists found the real culprit, metal carboxylate soaps. What are those? Well, they're created when fatty acids that hold paint together react with zinc and lead in the pigments. Turns out O'Keefe is not the only painter with this problem. Works by Van Gogh, Rembrandt, Chagall, and others have developed cases of art acne over the decades. Gets worse, these bumps can erupt, causing damage to the painting. Unfortunately, there's not a magic art ointment to cure art acne, and it can be a time-consuming process just to spot the bumps, much less restore the paintings. But there may be an app for that. A new app is being developed for museums by researchers at Northwestern University that they can use to find the warning signs of art acne. The hope is this could turn a process that could take days into something they can do in minutes. And then next, hopefully a cure for art pimples. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.